You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about a terrific podcast called Time to Eat the Dogs. It's hosted by Michael Robinson, a historian, and it's about exploration. Now, if you're clever, and I know you are because you listen to the New Books Network, you can probably figure out why a podcast about exploration would be called Time to Eat the Dogs. Well, Michael has interviewed many scholars and historians and researchers, and he even interviewed an astronaut about their books about exploration. You can find Time to Eat the Dogs at TimeToEatTheDogs.com. What else? You can also find it on iTunes. As I say, we really love this podcast at the New Books Network, and we love it so much that we're going to republish some of Michael's excellent interviews. And if I would just stop talking, which I'm going to do presently, you'll be able to hear one of those interviews. So I'm going to stop talking.
So much of the travel story is about what the traveler sees, where she goes, what's new and strange and marvelous. But the traveler is herself strange and marvelous to the people that she meets, someone who changes shape with every new place that she goes. It's time to eat the dogs. I'm Michael Robinson. Today, Joyce Ashantantang talks about her experiences as a traveler and a poet, from her home in Cameroon to her studies in Great Britain and later in the United States. Ashantantang is a professor of English at Hillier College here at the University of Hartford. She is the author of Beautiful Fire, published this year with Spears Media Press. Dr. Joyce Ashantantang, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So your poetry that you've written about in a number of books, it covers so many subjects. You talk about love and grief and incidents in domestic life. But through all of it, to me, comes the voice of the traveler. Could you talk a little bit about your first memories of travel when you lived in Cameroon?
I would say that my first recollections of who I was, I came in a small town called Kumba, where I was born and where I lived my first 4 years of my life, or stretching to 5 years. And when I came into being, that's when I realized that I'm on this earth. And here, I did not have my parents around. My parents were studying in England. And so from that young age, I started traveling to this strange place that I did not know, because I was told that my father was in London, and everything Western used to be attributed to me because my parents are in London. So if I had new clothes, they came from London. I got to learn the word telex very early because my aunt used to receive telex. And so that is how I started traveling. And I was...
So you were going to London?
I was not. My imagination.
Yeah.
So in my imagination. And I recall a man came. Later I got to know that was my dad. When I was 4, he visited for the first time.
Wow.
And he carried me on his lap and asked me, "Where's your dad?" And I said, "London." I didn't know he was the one. And then when my mother returned, that was, if I remember correctly, I think that was 1971 or 72. I was the only child that went to the airport, and I was seeing my mother for the first time. And I remember her legs were looking all dusty. Now I came to learn that she was wearing pantyhose. Pantyhose. And she brought a lot of toys for me. Mm. I had plastic building blocks. And so again, I had been traveling in my imagination. But when she returned, now that journey became a little bit concretized because she brought a lot of toys. I had the London Deca bus. She brought Mother Goose rhymes books. So I had this world, which later on I got to know is the world of a child growing up in the UK. I traveled within Cameroon with my aunt, who used to take me because each time she had to go somewhere, she took me along. And so I did local travels that I remember faintly. But because of my parents, the mega trip was in my head to the UK.
And then you followed them to the United Kingdom, or at least later for your graduate work. You did your college degree in Cameroon and then your graduate
work. Yes, in Cameroon.
Work.
So from Kumba, of course, my parents eventually settled in a town called Boya. Mm. And I lived with them there for 10 years. That's why that's one of my poems. I say, when I fall in love, I talk about Boya. Because although I'm not an indigenous of Boya, but that is my childhood place. And then after Boya, I stayed in Bamenda, which is another region of Cameroon. It's a northwest region. And as you know, the southwest region and northwest region make up the English-speaking sections, and which makes me one of few English-speaking Cameroonians who is really used to both regions. Mm-hmm. And so I never fall prey to the divide and rule that they want to say the Southwest and the Northwest are not together. And then I took a leap and went to Yaoundé for graduate studies, which is the French-speaking section of Cameroon. And what is not very clear from what I'm speaking is that with each crossing into each region, I'm crossing over bridges of stereotypes, and this is just within Cameroon.
Yeah.
So Southwest, going to Bamenda in the Northwest, I'm going to the Grassfield region. There are stereotypes about that area, and my going there made me used to the people from there. So there's always this Southwest-Northwest divide. You won't find me in that game because I have grown in both places. I have mutual respect. I'm not distrusting of them. Then, of course, crossing to Yaoundé is crossing to the Francophone majority, where, for the first time, my identity really took a hit because I had grown up with Cameroon as a nation state. And later on, I looked back and I think it's, is it Anderson that says the nation is an imagined state?
That's right, yes.
So what I thought Cameroon was came under serious attack because I grew up thinking it's one nation. We are united. I grew up during the fervor of nationalism. Mm-hmm. I'm born in 1966, so I grew up with that fervor of even independence. And then Cameroon became united in United Republic of Cameroon after the federal state in 1972. So I was a child of the unification. I was just about under 10 years old when that happened. So I was very excited. And when I reached Yaoundé and realized that I was a minority, that English was treated as a foreign language.
Yeah.
I couldn't speak English in the
public square.
In the public square, in the taxi. As soon as I started speaking even French, they can get from my accent that I'm Anglophone, and I become a subject of ridicule. And
so you felt that?
In Yaoundé, it was very clear. They made jokes of us, of our French. Even if we spoke it well, one of the characteristic humor is Anglo tu m'aime, oui je m'aime. It means, Anglo, do you love me? Yes, I love me. To provoke that we did not know how to speak French. And then another aspect of history also came into play. English-speaking Cameroon used to be ruled by Britain as part of Nigeria, part of the Eastern House in Nigeria. And so now we were called Biafrans because the East tried to break away. So in Yaoundé, I learned another label. I was a Biafran, le Biafran. And my sense of self started suffering, my sense of identity. And fortunately for me, I was in the English department where I was taught by English speakers for the most part. But for English-speaking Cameroonians who went to the sciences, the professor taught in the language, in his chosen language, and majority of the professors were Francophones. So you had students in law, geography, science. They came after 7 years in secondary and high school. Suddenly, over 80% of their lectures were in French.
Yeah.
And they could barely understand it to that level. A lot of them failed. If you failed, I think, three times, you were dismissed from the university. It was the only university that we had. So many students dropped out. And it was painful to see. Fortunately, in my household, I'm the only one who went to the University of Yaoundé because I was going to the English department. All of my siblings studied out of Cameroon because of that, because they were science students.
Wow.
Yes. So.
And then you left as well to pursue graduate studies.
And I went to the UK.
And what was it like for you? I mean, that must have also been a kind of a radical shift.
Definitely. But interestingly, like I said, okay, I had traveled through my parents' journey to England in my mind. And when they came, my father studied in Sussex, London, Exeter also, my mom in London. So, and then through her, she did a lot of, she did nutrition, education, and she worked in a hotel, Strand Palace Hotel, for a number of years. So I had traveled to the UK through their stories, through her utensils and stuff. And there I was now in my own right. It's one thing traveling in your mind. It's another thing actually being there in person. But in a way, it was like visiting a place that I had known.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw certain things, the phone booth. I could smile at things that my parents had talked about, and I could see them in my own right. But in terms of identity, when I got to Wales, what I did not know is that from Cameroon, I saw the UK as one entity.
Yeah.
In fact, I used to have letters written to me that they would say Wales, England. Because a lot of my friends and family didn't have the concept of it was England. They didn't know the UK with Wales and Ireland, you know. So they would put all my address and then add England underneath. And so I went to Wales and discovered something else. I remember once I was complaining about colonialism and talking. And then this Welsh suddenly said, Joyce, I think we went through the same thing. Like, what are you talking about? Oh, we were being oppressed too. And then the Irish. And then the Scottish. In fact, there's this good joke that one of my Scottish friends told me about when God was creating Scotland. That he got Angel Gabriel to show the Scottish what he had in store for them. And this beautiful landscape, and it's showing, and they're wondering, this is too nice. This is perfect, you know. And then he says, but God, why are you giving all this wonderful thing. Where's the catch? Says, wait until you see the nebos I give you. You know, and then the Welsh had this postcard. It's like, keep Wales clean, throw your litter in England. So it was my first introduction to identity politics in the UK. And for the first time, I could align myself with a white person.
Mm.
Like in terms of, we are all oppressed. And not surprisingly, my close friends during my days at the university were either Welsh, Scottish, or Irish, you know, because there was that shared thread that we had a common oppressor. And that's something that I would never have known from Cameroon.
Mm.
But then, because of what was I studying at this time? Library and information science. So, which led me to, again, another solidifying who I was, my sense of self, because of my studies, I became very familiar with reference books. And each time I would rush to look for Cameroon, the way Cameroon was represented. And that's when I became sadly aware that the marginalization I had felt in Yaoundé as an Anglophone was actually replicated in the way Cameroon is represented in the global imagination.
Mm.
So,
in terms of language,
whenever Cameroon is presented, it was presented as a French country.
Mm-hmm.
So the English speaking section was erased. In fact, it became even clearer when I saw this book that was put together. Now is it Jahan Jans? I can't remember the editor, but he was trying to do a reference text of literatures from Africa. And he structured the book by country. And now he had a problem because he had done some work in Anglophone Cameroon. So how was he going to put Anglophone Cameroon literature? Because he was going via nation states.
Mm-hmm.
And this was supposed to be Anglophone African literature. Cameroon, Anglophone Cameroon is not a state. So you had Ghana, you had Kenya, you had Uganda, and guess what he did, which was good because we had some visibility, but it was painful. He put Cameroon as an appendix, Anglophone Cameroon literature as an appendix under Nigerian literature.
Wow. Yeah.
Because that's the only way. So he did a little history to, you know, they were used to be part of Nigeria. But we could not get a section on our own because it's Anglophone. He's trying to put Anglophone Cameroon literature, and he was not putting it by region. He was doing it via the Anglophone African countries.
Mm.
And so that is when I became aware that, wow, I'm not really represented. And that sense of self that was already suffering in Cameroon became even acute for me out there. And it became a crusade for me that I need to make my part of the world known. I need to speak for myself. I need to take my voice to places. And when I came to write my PhD dissertation, that played a role in my topic because...
Which you pursued in New York City.
In New York City. And that is very interesting because, okay, after Wales, I went back to Cameroon. I went back to Cameroon, spent a few years. I went back in 91 and I came to the U.S. in 94. And...
Was that your first trip to the States?
No, my first trip, interestingly, was in 1987. I came as a representative, a youth representative from Cameroon. I was first year student at the university at the time. And there was a 6-week program here for young artists. And I represented Cameroon as an actress. And I came here. And that was interesting to me because that was the first time I got to live in close proximity with African Americans. They were actually representatives from the Caribbean and Africa and Mexico. And each time we went somewhere, they made sure that you had one African, at least a Caribbean or African American and a Mexican to share space. So it was my first time to get to know. I traveled to England. I met students from different parts of the world, but America was a new thing for me. And I had done African American literature, but that was the first time to really interact with African Americans. But that short stay, I didn't really see much in terms of identity. I was privileged during that visit. The places I got in, I don't think I've even entered some of those spaces since I got back here. I was fortunate. I even had lectures from O.C. Davis.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and I got to know later how big he was. Went to the White House, went to Boblo Island. We were international guests representing our countries. So then I came back in 94. And when I came back in 94, I was now older and I was here to stay. It's a different thing to be a visitor and stay and enter racism. That is when my identity got redefined.
Yeah.
Because before now, interestingly, when I was in the UK, I think I was sheltered by the student life, you know, so I can't think of any racial encounter. I can't, because I was a student and a student with a mind to go back, I was framed that way. Yeah. So I saw everything in that prism. I'm just a visitor here. I'm just studying here and I'm going back. But when I came to the US to stay and live here, I started noticing the way I was defined. That is when I became black.
Mm.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I was thinking actually as I read your poems that some of your experience reminds me a little bit of the Harvard historian Henry Louis Gates has this documentary. I think it came out about 6 or 7 years ago on being black in Latin America. And some of the interviews that he does are really, really interesting about it. It's exactly what you just said, this moment when a person feels they've become something else. And so could you talk a bit about that?
Yes. So I was surprised, you know, I've already dealt with the level of being a minority as an Anglophone Cameroonian. And then I enter this space and I realize that I'm also another minority here and I'm black. My blackness is not something that had defined me. It had not defined me. And they even had another nice name for it, colored.
Mm.
You know, I was colored. Whatever, I didn't, what does that mean? And it was very interesting because when I had to feel the form, I was forced into being an African American.
Huh.
You know,
you weren't given any other
option. I wasn't given an option. And each time when they say other, should I say Cameroon American? But Cameroon does not allow dual citizenship. So Cameroon would not recognize that. What is Cameroon American? They don't recognize that. And African American, that's not me. That appellation came about because it is it encompasses Africa, but I know exactly where I'm from. So you sign that and you realize that, okay, that is who you're supposed to be here. But what does that entail? And then within the Black community, there are these spaces. You're continental African, you're Caribbean, you're African American. And each group seems to guard that jealously.
Mm.
And yet outside, we are all lumped together. And then within this push and pull, there are people who think we should be one. There are other people who look at this group as being, oh, I'm better than you. I'm better than that. And I, in order to not to get my identity further fragmented, I had to quickly come to a place where I could be whole with myself. And this is what I came up with. I decided I'm African, I'm Black. And when it comes to African Americans and Caribbeans who are Black, I relate to them in a very emotional way.
Mm.
And this is what I tell a lot of my young Africans that I talk to. I tell them, the way I look at them is, I go back to the slavery times. I think of those who came here. I want to imagine that when they got here, after that long trip, not knowing where they are, they must have hoped and prayed and dreamt that their relatives would find them.
Yeah.
They must have wondered, you know, some died with that, wondering whether the people, not some, all of them must have died wondering, you know, whether their families ever found out what happened to them. And so I decided to look at myself like one of those relatives who has come. And I'm not going to get pulled into any games about who is better than who is not. There are Africans who come here and they don't know the history. So they look at some African Americans and say, oh, they're lazy. They're lazy. Why can't they have all this? Why can't they better themselves? You don't know this story. History disenfranchised them. And some of that is still affecting them today. A lot of Africans who come here, they come here from middle-class homes. They come here with a sense of purpose. Yes, they've had colonialism. It's not the same thing. And so I come to that with understanding. And then you have African Americans who, because of the history, because of the brainwashing, they look at Africans and say, oh, they're not civilized. Oh, they speak with an accent. Oh, they're inferior. I forgive their ignorance. I'm not going to be drawn into that. And Baldwin, when James Baldwin met Chinua Achebe for the first time in the 70s, they met at the African Literature Association conference. Baldwin said, we have been separated for 400 years. The plan was that we should never meet. But we have met.
Yeah.
And that's the way I look at it. And interestingly, when Baldwin died, he left his briefcase for Chinua Achebe. You know, and so that is the way I look at it. These divisions in the Black, amongst Blacks, it's a divide and rule. And so I embrace that identity on paper, African American, if that's what they say I am. When it comes to the Africa, I know exactly who I am, what I am, and it was very interesting. And at the first few years here, when I went back to Cameroon, I was conflicted about my minority status there. I'm like, wait a minute. I tried to educate them. I'm like, do you know that we belong to a bigger minority called Blacks? You know, we're here fighting with this one here. There's this other one there that we're dealing with. And at some point, I had wanted to just embrace this Black minority that it's fluid, doesn't put me in any particular group.
Yeah.
For some time, I was this nameless Black person in America. And then after a while, I'm like, no, I'm going to be Black from Cameroon. And
do you feel, you work with a lot of different students, a lot of students of color. Do you feel that they also identify you differently than an African American? Or it's a big generalization, but do you have any thoughts about that?
Yes. One thing that I've done is that I've tried not to keep them in a gray area as to where I belong. So day one of my introduction, they know I'm originally from Cameroon, so they know I'm African. But for my Caucasian students, that doesn't stop them from thinking I'm African-American.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But for the black students, whether African-Americans or Caribbean or African, they know exactly
the distinction
the distinction that I'm making. And because I know also what stereotypes they bring into that, even though they are black, from the Caribbean, from African-American, from Africa, I take upon myself to, as part of their learning in that class, that by the time they are done, they may be unified in their thinking the way I have unified mine. Because it's a big thing, these divisions between the black, and sometimes people don't want us to talk about it. It's almost like, let's keep it in-house. Let's keep it in-house. But it's something that I want my... At the end of the day, they all have the same fears, the same problems. But because they're all distinct and they come to the table with different fears and aspirations because of that color, they're lucky to have me who is aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
So if we are having, let's say, office hours and stuff, sometimes they bring some of these things up. Either it's my African students who are using a name that I think it's an abbreviation, and I talk to them about it. And now because they see Ashun Tantang, they can now confess to me that my name was longer than that. But I cut it short. But the day you asked us to say names, I said that the name you heard me say, it's the first time I'm saying that. But they said it to me because they were now confident to say it. And then when I come with empathy to the African-American history, to the problems being faced, then I see African-Americans confessing one or two things to me. And now they're having more regard for the ancestral land, you know. So it's not something that they want to hide because they think it brings them down, you know. So it's a very interesting place to inhabit. For example, I came to the U.S. to learn about something like Kwanzaa, okay? It becomes, so what is my relationship to that? Should I say that this is some bullshit? I don't know. I'm from the continent. I don't know about Kwanzaa. I don't know what that means. But when I read about it, when I understand how it came about, then I realized that within the setup in America, it became important for some of these rituals to be created. And so there's a need for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I may not, yes, I don't observe Kwanzaa, but I wouldn't spit on it because I understand it, where it is coming from.
Yeah.
And so somebody who is not educated would just, maybe from the continent, maybe like, oh, they do this nonsense, this bullshit. I understand it. I also understand the fact that if somebody decides to wear cowries from their head to their toe to show they're African, I may not do that. Well, there's something that...
But it still has meaning.
It has meaning. It has meaning. And you don't have to have grown in that society, or you don't have to know everything about that Ugandan culture to wear it. Growing up as African American, just knowing that this is, it's, I don't even understand what that space can be. One of a staff member here approached me, and I was talking about, we're talking about ancestral stuff, and she got very teary eyed. She says, "Joyce, you can talk about places and things. I can't because of slavery." But then I told her one thing. I said, but guess what? They said there's a silver lining for every cloud. But because of slavery, you may be fortunate to have some written history on that family than I have. I can't even go beyond my great grandfather. So if you follow, if you are lucky to follow your grandparents and stuff, because you came out here, you may have ancestry up to a certain point that I don't have. Yes, it links to slavery, but before that, you may have this historical records that I don't.
Yeah,
I don't have. And she said, yes, you're right about that, that at least she can trace her family to great-great-grand. I said, there you go. So you have that history that I don't have. Yes, I am from Cameroon, but because of this history was not written down. In fact, it's I went to see my sister who just came to Canada, and I was fortunate that she, because of me prodding and prodding, she had a meeting with my two surviving aunts who were able to give a family history. And honestly, on my dad's side, we went back as far as great-great-gran on his father's side. On the mother's side, I think we went back like four generations and ended there. And when we say four generations, maybe it's just the name.
Yeah.
We can't even see things. My grandfather had 16 wives. At least I'm happy that he had, my dad said 17. My brother says my dad said 18. But at my birthday, really, he in the US here, he had said 18 wives. But my sister, in that interview, the aunties could only remember 16. So, but at least they could give us the 16 wives and each of the wives' children.
Well, that's incredible.
That's incredible. So that's how far we've wow. gone. And this is, I'm giving you, this is information that I just got. So when I meet African Americans, I try to give them this thing so that there's something to hold on to. We all got dispossessed, you know, and but this identity, this shifting identity. And so here I am, but I still have my foothold in Cameroon, because the truth about identity is that in as much as I don't like the marginalization, but that's where I grew up. I stayed in Yaoundé for long. I'm still fond of the country, and it still defines me. But right now I'm living, you live in a space, sometimes it's limbo. In America, they tell me I have an accent. I go to Cameroon, I also have an accent.
Well, I was actually going to ask you, that's kind of the, you know, it's completing the circle. What does it feel like to go back? In fact, before you answer that question, could you read a poem from your book about travel titled Between Airports, which is published in your book, A Basket of Flaming Ashes?
Yes, this poem definitely captures my feelings crossing those boundaries. Between airports. My goodbyes are broken pieces of me flung back. My welcome, a quilt of my fragmented self. In between are bundles of memories, wrapped in papers, sealed in bags, labeled in doubt, packed in fear, limit 50 pounds per suitcase.
So when you talk about this kind of fear, packing, is it the fear of hitting the weight limit, or is it the anxiety of packing up all this stuff for the people back in Cameroon?
Both, because when you visit home, as in Cameroon, that's when your sense of being a foreigner in the U.S. comes up, because suddenly you're trying to take the whole country back. You know, it's everything, even soda, pamplemousse, which is a drink that I don't drink soda here in the U.S., but I'm trying to bring soda across the border because I grew up drinking pamplemousse and I like it. I want to bring pamplemousse. People bring gifts to show that they care, and you want to take their gifts along. There are some things that you want to bring back just for the heck of it, maybe to put in your house, and you look at it. In the scheme of things, do I really need that? But you do. It's part of your identity. So it's almost like I want pieces of my identity to take with me. And then you have this suitcase limit that then, so there's the limit. Then there's also this invasion of who you are when you arrive, because they're going through your stuff, to see what you have brought in.
Yeah.
Most of these things are usually foodstuffs, things that are edible, but suddenly it's become like you're some alien.
Yeah.
You know, you have to start explaining yourself. And so you're packing things. They bring you nice melon seeds that have been made into pudding, egusi pudding. If it was in Cameroon, everybody knows that this is food. Now you've been asked, what is this? Is there meat in there? And suddenly your food is being dissected as if it's some specimen in a lab. So that's where the fear comes from, is that are they going to identify this as something to be thrown away? So we try to find the English equivalents, the scientific names of these things to say, oh, I'm having colocasia, whatever, whatever. And now suddenly it looks like some plant. I remember when I went to see my sister who is visiting in Canada, she had just come through that airport with the same stuff. Now I'm taking the stuff to the USA.
Yeah.
And I am stopped. What do you have there? And I said, bitter leaf. Oh, bitter leaf? Was that? I had to go to Google to find the equivalent. And I think it said ironweed or something like that. And because of that, I was pulled out. And I had to wait at the immigration there for hours for them to go and put that through the machines to see. And then, of course, they realize that it is harmless. But in doing that, they see melon seeds that have not been crushed. Oh, we don't allow melon seeds that have not been crushed. I said, but this melon seeds came through this airport. And they said, well, they came from which country? I said, Cameroon. Oh, we allow them to come in from Cameroon. But now you're taking them from Canada. We don't know, because we will not allow it if it's from Nigeria. I know that was just bullshit.
Yeah.
And they kept me there for 2 hours. So that anxiety. So when you're packing from Cameroon, you know, this anxiety. And with that anxiety, your already fragmented self is fragmented further.
Even more.
More. Yeah. And so that's why I said my goodbyes are broken pieces of me flung back. I get to the airport and I don't know what food item is going to make it, which is not going to make it. That is the feeling. And then with all that anxiety, you're packing. You're also packing in a way that they can see that and believe that you're a respectable person. You know, the way you package it. We try to use Ziploc bags and stuff. I don't want to put it in some flimsy papers that you think, okay. But sometimes all that packaging to show that it's something to be respected doesn't stop it. And then I arrive here. I said, my welcome is a quilt of my fragmented self. I try to put myself together.
Back together again.
Yes, I'm back here. I need to survive. I need to live. I need to learn to love this place.
Yeah.
It is home. And so I put myself together.
Well, we're actually glad that you're back here and together. Joyce Ashantantang, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And it's been a pleasure. I haven't had this kind of conversation where I look at my travels and what they've meant to me. And so thank you. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
That's it for today. The music was composed by Zabrat. Make sure you check out the Time to Eat the Dogs website for podcast links and other exploration-related stuff. And if you get the chance, please take a minute to rate and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps make the show visible to new listeners. And if you want to recommend a guest or make a comment, feel free to contact me at timetoeatthedogs, that's one word, lowercase, @gmail.com. See you next week.